Matthew Huey is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Connecticut. He is the author of many books, including White Bound, Nationalist and Anti-Racist, and The Shared Meanings of Race. He is the co-author of the new book, The Wrongs of the Right, Language, Race, and the Republican Party in the Age of Obama. And we welcome Matthew Huey to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
What brought you and Gregory Parks to this particular subject?
Well, we were quite interested in what has been, I'd say, a gulf that's developed in terms of race in this nation. We have on the one hand what we might call post-racial discourse, this belief that issues related to race have gone away, they were solved with the civil rights movement, that everything is more or less equal. And on the other hand, we have quite stark racial realities in which segregation, for instance, in our schools is just about as bad as it was in the 1950s and 60s. Hate groups are on a rise. Inequality in some ways, for instance, the wealth gap has grown, especially since the housing collapse. And so we have this disconnect between racial realities and post-racial discourse that I think leads a lot of people to think that simply because our discourse has become nicer, that race must not be a problem. And when we look at how coded language that is subtle, seemingly nice, and pleasant and polite actually can still use kind of racial discontent, can signal racialized code words and meanings and significance toward, in particular, political agendas. And that's what we saw with the election of Barack Obama in his first 4 years and how right-wing media and right-wing political activists use these kind of subtle and polite code words to activate racial animus.
When you say activate, it brings up, and I'll ask this question, although it seems obvious in the sense of, so did the election cause any of this, or did it just allow us to reflect and see what was already there?
That's a great question. I think in many ways, we can't blame the election of Barack Obama on this. So when we look through the nation's history, and let's go back, for example, to the Reconstruction era, in which we saw Hiram Revels and Blanche K. Bruce, who were the first African Americans elected to Congress during the Reconstruction era. So this is just after the Civil War. This time it was the Democrats that were using kind of coded language against the Republicans, because these were both Republican congressmen, in which they talked about their lack of work ethic, their lack of education, their supposed dysfunctions and pathologies and so forth. Sometimes there was very overt racial discourse used, but sometimes it was subtle, just like we see today. Fast forward 100 years to the second Civil War, what we might call the Civil Rights Movement, and the Southern Strategy, which took place during the 1940s, 50s, 60s, in which this time the GOP turned to a strategy of winning elections by exploiting anti-African-American racism and fears of, let's say, a growing federal government amidst Southern white voters. For example, one of the key strategists for Nixon at the time, this was Kevin Phillips, I believe, in 1968, said, who needs Manhattan? Who needs to win Manhattan when you can get the electoral votes of 11 Southern states? And those 11 states just so happened to be the 11 of the old Confederacy. So again, today, opposition to Obama has found expression and growth through implicit and explicit race baiting from the right. So the rise of the birthers, the Tea Party movement, and the propaganda wing of right-wing media together signal the rise, I think, of a kind of second Southern strategy.
And it isn't subtle, is it?
In some ways, it is subtle. In some ways, there are code words that are used to signal issues about African Americans or about race without saying African American or black or race. To say, for example, welfare or urban, or to mention particular communities. These kind of words signal to people a particular demographic, a particular racial group, a particular class and racial group that we find and that other social scientists have found that people understand is really carrying a racialized meaning. So they don't have to say it explicitly. They can often say it quite implicitly. But even if they do say things explicitly, we found that people often, try to explain away what was said. For example, let's see here. In in 2008, a Republican woman in the San Bernardino County in California mailed a newsletter to 200 of their club members that depicted Barack Obama on a food stamp. And on that food stamp was a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken, a piece of watermelon, spare ribs, and a pitcher of Kool-Aid. All stereotypes of supposedly black food that carry a racist connotation that blacks can't control themselves from overconsumption of these items. But that organization's president once called on the carpet about that, indicated that she had no idea why anyone would take offense to the image and that it was all just food to her. It didn't mean anything. So that's quite overt to some people, but then it allows other people to say, oh, I didn't mean that. That's not racist. That's not whatever. And so it provides an easy kind of escape hatch for drumming up anti-black sentiments, but then having that escape hatch from it, that get-out-of-jail-free card, if you will.
Well, you talk about the escape hatch, but it seems that the escape hatch, which has been around forever, but it certainly has intensified over the last 6 years, and that is by someone simply beginning a sentence or ending a sentence with the outright declaration that I am not a racist.
Yeah, that's probably one of the best ways to know that someone probably is about to say something racist.
Right.
When they say, you know, I'm not a racist, but, and then whatever follows. And I think one of the reasons that that's occurring is because we've become in this country so I'd say, wed or married to this belief that racial issues really have been conquered, that we have achieved some form of racial equality, and that really, there is no more racism anymore, except amongst a few, you know, radical bad seeds out there who still wear white hoods or put swastikas on their arms. And the fact of the matter is that a majority of Americans, regardless of politics, carry some form of anti-black sentiment. But anti-black sentiment also manifests more often than not amongst people who carry conservative leanings.
So let me ask the question, and you address it in the book, but does it work with the political right using these code words, using this language, looking at the way that the Republican Party acts in this age of Obama? Is it working? Because you look at their current situation, and it doesn't seem to be overly successful.
I think you have to take that into consideration of 2008 and 2012 and who the opposition was. If we think back to 2008, this really was a perfect storm for the first black president to be elected. You had an incredibly unpopular candidate, George W. Bush, who was leaving. McCain was stepping in. McCain already had quite a great deal of, let's say, racial baggage when he refused to support the Martin Luther King Day becoming law when he was senator in Arizona. You had that party that was in power during an economic depression, an unpopular war, et cetera. You had a lot of people that were, even Republicans, that were not happy with their party. You had an incredibly, you know, insurmountable task for the Republican Party to put someone forward to still promote Republican points, but yet appeal to disaffected Republicans. On top of that, the Democratic machine that year was incredibly media savvy. Had a brilliant message of these kind of vague but yet abstractly positive words of hope and change and so forth, and really was the perfect storm for Barack Obama to be elected. Again, in 2012, the Romney camp made a great deal of mistakes. But when you look at whether or not this kind of racial animus worked, it still brought over usually white conservative men from the South. And that continues to work. And it continues, I think, to work even if it doesn't win the election. The consequences of that is that it may be working for congressional elections, state elections, and local elections, which we are seeing, in which a lot of Democrats and a lot of people of color are losing their seats.
I do want to go back to 2008 because I'm reading Hillary Clinton's autobiography and memoir of the time, Hard Choices, and I'm struck by her description of the campaign, of that historic campaign where you have the first woman candidate and the first African-American candidate battling it out, and the African-American candidate wins. So there was going to be history either way there, but even that he made it through the primary season is a fascinating thing to look at.
It absolutely is. That was quite remarkable, and I'm looking forward to more historians and political scientists making sense of that election in terms of the racial and gender politics. But I mean, even Hillary played the race card in a few places and during the primary race, in which she, you know, claimed to really be, you know, the candidate for white working people. And so this racial animus is used quite a bit. The point is, if it's used and directed toward the right demographic, it's often going to carry a lot more political purchase than in other ways.
Let us talk for a moment about the Tea Party and how that plays into this, because as the subtitle of the book demonstrates, Language, Race, and the Republican Party in the Age of Obama. You include the Tea Party in that Republican Party.
We do. You know, we include the Tea Party, the birther movement, right-wing media. We center on the GOP, but we include all those groups.
So is one worse than the other in the sense of when it comes to the wrongs of the right, that one seems to exercise these wrongs more than another?
In some ways, I think that what we see with the Tea Party is a magnification of some of the things that are within the Republican Party. And in our book, we tried to move step by step through how this kind of subtle and sometimes overt racial discourse is used and relies upon a kind of dangerous and white supremacist set of assumptions that hold at least four dimensions. And these four dimensions are seen quite a bit, especially in Tea Party discourse. So first, people of color, especially African Americans in general and Barack Obama in specific, are framed as dysfunctional, pathological, social pariahs that threaten the very foundations of Western democracy and civilization. Second, white people and often white members of the Tea Party and a kind of amorphous white culture that they often talked about are framed as the manifestations of morality and are often conflated with an authentic form of U.S. citizenship and patriotism as true Americans, if you will. Third, whites are often constructed then as the proper administrators and caretakers of an increasingly diverse society. And here the Tea Party often frames whiteness as kind of the paternalistic savior of the nation, if not the world, in which whites should just be left alone to their own devices to govern and decide what's best for others. And then fourth, white people, and again this kind of amorphous construction of white culture, are framed as the kind of embattled victims of a politically correct and totalitarian society run amok, in which whites simply aren't allowed to speak their mind or exercise basic human rights under the leadership of politically correct folks like Obama. So these dimensions of black dysfunction, white patriotism, white paternalism, and white victimhood are seen in the GOP, but I think magnified amongst groups like the Tea Party, that I think together reveal the existence of a kind of modern Herrenvogt or master race, to use the Nazi term, a kind of Herrenvogt democracy in the midst of our supposedly post-racial or colorblind era.
Matthew Huey is the co-author of the new book, The Wrongs of the Right, Language, Race, and the Republican Party in the Age of Obama. I do want to focus on the media for a moment. When you look at figures like Laura Ingraham, Ann Coulter, Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, Bill O'Reilly, is that a fringe? Or is that a very large portion of the conservative media that is speaking to what the ratings tell us is a pretty large base?
When you poll people that have conservative leanings, they certainly are listening to those people that you just mentioned. So I don't think they're a fringe. They're heard and listened to, and I think often people take their speaking points from what those media voices are saying. So I would definitely say that they're not fringe. Their discourse now I think is even more mainstream, and this is what's unsettling to both myself and my co-author Dr. Parks, is that this type of discourse that they use, those four aspects of that racial framing that I just went through, black dysfunction, white patriotism, white paternalism, and white victimhood, are woven all throughout the tapestry of that media discourse that they constantly voice. And that the Tea Party or the Republican Party or the birthers or kind of any aspect of right-wing discourse and practice can draw from that fabric selectively to weave their own kind of agenda is what's so unsettling. And that it works, that it resonates with people, is what's so amazing.
And especially, I mean, and again, I look at people like, you know, Sean Hannity has a show every night. Bill O'Reilly has a show every night. Rush Limbaugh has a show every afternoon on the radio. You look at somebody like Ann Coulter, who does not have to answer to an audience every day. And just seems to come out every once in a while to throw some bombs and then go back. The fact that she is not only popular regularly on the bestseller list, is a regular guest on Fox and other media outlets as well. Media outlets often looking for the quote other side. The fact that she has become a mainstream voice, I find interesting and quite frankly disturbing.
I do too. I think it's a part of something about a part of our I think Western cultural logic that subscribes to this notion of dualities and that there must be a kind of sense of balance, right? So if we have someone that goes on the air that says the Earth is round, then we have to get someone else on the air to say no, it's flat, and
right.
then the conversation is somehow
right.
balanced, right? And so, in some ways, having these incredibly radical right-leaning, unhinged and just complete fear-mongering when it comes to race is reframed as somehow a balanced perspective, as somehow the other side of the coin, when in fact it's not framed for what it is, as lunatic, unhinged behavior and rhetoric that has no basis in reality. For instance, the fact that Donald Trump had so much purchase in his kind of quasi-run, I'm running, I'm not running, discourse
right.
in which he was planning or maybe not planning at all just to get ratings for his shows to run for president, and he married himself to the birther platform, which has absolutely no merit. I mean, if the only way that the birther platform makes any sense is if you forget Barack Obama's mother, which is a white woman, you know, from middle America, PhD, anthropologist, right? It makes no sense. If you're born to an American citizen, ipso facto, you're an American. It doesn't even matter where you're born. So let's say the birthers are correct. Let's go out on that crazy ledge and say the birthers are correct that Obama was born in Kenya, which he wasn't. But even if you said that and proved that somehow, he still would be an American and eligible to be president. You know, McCain wasn't born in the United States. He was born in a military installation outside of the U.S., but no one used that type of discourse to reframe him, largely because he's white and conservative, right? So the fact that this type of lunatic discourse is voiced and is rationalized, reframed, legitimated, is somehow balanced, is quite scary.
And some of that is just right-left, too, and it wouldn't necessarily be racist. I mean, I look at what was done to John Kerry as far as the Swift Boat movement and painting him as a coward when all the evidence would show that he's a military hero. There's not race a part of that, but that is a different party ideology, obviously.
Oh, exactly. I mean, the two-party system in the U.S., I think, lends to that kind of exploitation of dualities, right? And is completely antagonistic and tries to make mountains out of molehills consistently in order to disqualify the opponent. What's interesting here is that you have that type of strategy that often, when there is a non-white candidate in play, that uses that implicit kind of subtle racial discourse in order to further activate that political agenda.
Do you see any of this fundamentally changing when the first African-American president leaves office?
I really don't. I wish I could be more optimistic, but I'm a social scientist and that makes me realistic. So when I look at the data, I'm just not seeing any type of large-scale racial progress. Now, let me put a caveat on that. When you look at our racial attitudes and the ways that people talk about race, that's improved over time. And Americans are much more what we might call racially tolerant than they were, say, 50 or 60 years ago. But when you look at the allocation of resources, when you look at not just race as attitude, but race as structure, material resources, hierarchy, inequality, you'll see that in some ways we've improved, but in many ways we've gone stagnant or we've actually become worse. So in some ways, the election of Barack Obama as an African-American president then allows some people to try to legitimate this post-racial discourse and say there are no problems. A black person was president. There are no more barriers. You know, the day after, I think, Obama won the election, November of 2008, the New York Times headline was Obama, racial barrier falls in heavy turnout.
Right.
And I thought, I didn't know the racial barrier fell overnight. It's amazing. Right? And the Wall Street Journal said that now we can put to bed the myth, quote-unquote myth of racism in this splendid country. So that's what I worry about, that not only will things not get better, but people, in fact, might use and spin the election of Obama as somehow more reasons to not talk about race, not to look at our racial realities, and to further embed ourselves with this so-called post-racial or colorblind discourse.
The name of the book is The Wrongs of the Right, Language, Race, and the Republican Party in the Age of Obama. It is written by Matthew Huey and Gregory Parks. And Matthew Huey has been our guest. Matthew, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Terrific. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is The Wrongs of the Right. It is published by NYU Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.